If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now it's time to say hello to Danny Orendorf. He's the curator in residence at the Charlotte Street Foundation, and he's been in Kansas City for a year now. So we thought this might be a nice opportunity to get a good look at the Kansas City art scene through his eyes. Hi, Danny. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your background. Where did you come from, and what are sort of your interests, your past interests that brought you here?
Oh, wow. So it's kind of a long story, but I really got involved in the arts while I was in college at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona. I was raised on the south side of Chicago, went to undergrad out there, did for a journalism degree. And while I was there, I became kind of frustrated with the fact that I was learning a lot about how to write properly or correctly, but not really learning anything to write about. So I got involved with the arts and began interning for the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. And from there, kind of just increasingly became interested in curatorial work, from really a kind of journalistic point of view, so very much concerned with social and political and economic issues and how those things are apparent within art practices and contemporary art production. So from there, I moved on to the Bay Area, where I lived for a couple of years working for the Berkeley Art Museum and doing some independent curatorial work for an organization called SF Camerawork. And then wound up back in Chicago for graduate school and then came here to Kansas City. But I'd say my through line really has been either paying particular amounts of attention to artists that do address sociological concerns, contemporary political situations, economic situations, both explicitly and implicitly through general art practice, choice of materials, experimental forms, and so on.
Have you found a lot of artists in Kansas City who are doing the kind of thing that has historically interested you?
Well, it's been interesting because I would say that Kansas City is a very different art scene or has a very different art scene than the art scenes that I'm familiar with in Chicago and San Francisco. I would say that Kansas City in particular has such a strong studio culture. So there's a lot of artists that get to spend more time than I've ever noticed in other cities in studios that are larger.
I feel like the answer to this might be self-evident, but what do you think accounts for that?
Well, I mean, I think that Kansas City is a little bit more of an easier place to live than Chicago or San Francisco in terms of actual, you know, the economics of the place. And I do think that there's maybe less competition for some of the really supported opportunities within Kansas City, which is great in the sense that there are a number of artists that receive, you know, free or very low rent studio space. And these spaces are enormous compared to the kind of spaces I knew artists were working in these other cities. So I think that's a testament to the city and its valuing of arts and art practice here in Kansas City. And I also think that it's a testament to the legacy within Kansas City of very meticulous, methodical, labor-intensive, time-consuming art making. You know, I think that artists here look inward more so than maybe other places where they're, you know, forced to confront social and political and economic situations maybe a little more presently in their everyday lives, which I think leads to the kind of practices here that are very formally concerned, investigations of abstraction, materiality, and so forth.
That's interesting, talking about looking inward, and that you think that the studio culture here has something to do with that. Explain a little bit more what you mean by a studio culture.
Yeah, well, I would say that artists spend a lot of time within their own and each other's studios. So I find that there's really strong sense of keeping up with one another here in Kansas City in terms of the sort of activity that's happening privately within a studio. So it's more, I think, concerned with personal sets of investigations into color, into form, into materiality. And it's a real kind of focus on making, I think.
Can you talk about maybe a specific artist relationship that you've witnessed where people are visiting one another's studios and working on these kinds of projects, witnessing what one another are doing and are influenced by that?
Oh, sure. I think that, you know, to me personally, a good friend and somebody I really admire here in town is Gary Noland. He just recently won one of our visual artist awards from Charlotte Street Foundation. And he is an incredibly generous, gregarious person that has this great centripetal force around himself. I think that artists that are, you know, emerging out of an art school context and figuring out their way in the world as an independent producer, and, you know, artists that have been working in town for, you know, decades, know Gary, have encountered his artwork, have been to his studio, and vice versa.
Describe his artwork for us.
So Gary makes, you know, some very idiosyncratic objects and items. I mean, so he recently was known for making these quilt-like vinyl tape works that he would make on the floor of his studio. And in the process of sticking the vinyl tape in these very intricate and beautiful patterns onto the floor, he was also pulling up sort of analog information about the very place that he made the work. So when he displays the work, the front side is, you know, what was actually sticking to the ground. So it captures this really amazing kind of patina of wood marks and dust and grime, and it creates just this amazing surface that you can really kind of explore and get lost in and see the real kind of sticky materiality of.
It sounds like a different way of seeing the ground.
Oh, sure. I think that Gary has a very interesting relationship to the studio, right? And so this is kind of what I'm talking about in terms of studio practice. I think that he has a very attuned sense of where he is while he's making his work and, you know, in his other projects, kind of sourcing discarded materials from around his studio and repurposing them or reimagining them into these almost kind of stalagmite type evidence of where he is and the kind of landscape that he works within. So I do think that that's the kind of practice that I see a lot of other artists kind of emulating, having a very kind of curious and unconventional sort of process, but very much analog to the very space within their working.
So going back to the original question that got us here, though, it does seem like maybe this is all a way of saying that there maybe isn't a huge culture of politically and socially engaged artwork in Kansas City.
Yeah, I would say that that has been an art practice that is underrepresented, at least in my sort of brief encounter with the Kansas City arts community. I do think that public practices, so people that are doing work in public spaces that are engaging the social and political and economic issues that do confront Kansas City, I find that sort of practice to be more rare than the very studio-intensive kinds of practices that I encounter much more frequently. That being said, I do believe that it is changing slowly. There is a shift, you know, represented by artists like A. Bitterman and Sean Starwitz, the Rocket Grants program that Charlotte Street supports as well. Is very much concerned with fostering more local art production that confronts or addresses the social and political and economic issues of Kansas City and Lawrence. So I feel like there is a change afoot But that being said, I do think that primarily the formalist or the sort of studio-based culture is the strongest here in Kansas City.
What can be done to encourage this other kind of artwork that you're seeing less often?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think for one, I would love to see within the programming of Kansas City, both at, you know, Charlotte Street Foundation and at other institutions throughout the city, be them museums like the Kemper or the Nelson or maybe even the library, more opportunities for artists to intersect with professionals working outside of the arts, whether or not that be a person that's working explicitly in an activist way, whether that's a scientist, whether or not that's somebody from agriculture. But I do believe that part of the job of creating new and strong and vibrant audiences for the arts in Kansas City is to make the arts a little bit more relevant to the life and issues confronting a broader population.
Do you think Midwestern politeness might play any role in this?
That is such a great question, because I was recently part of a focus group and I was asked to describe Kansas City in three words. And one of my words was polite. And I do believe that there is a kind of Midwestern wholesomeness, perhaps, to some of the general social dealings within and without, outside of the arts. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like there is a hunger locally for more criticality, to push for stronger voices in the journalism.
That's really interesting, because that's something I hear a lot, too. But I have also, to be fair, kind of witnessed that when it happens, it's not taken particularly well.
No.
There's a very strong protective streak within Kansas City's arts community. And I've often wondered if that's because it's maybe just in terms of the economic and political climate, maybe not the safest time to be criticized or to have something. I mean, it's I'm just curious what you think about whether when people say they want that, whether that's true.
Right. Well, I think that there will always be a defense to a negative criticism that emerges. And I think that's, you know, inevitable in situations where it is personal or hard to separate the personal from your art production.
Which throughout the arts, it's so it is so personal.
It is so personal. And I do think that there are kind of traveling in groups of people that will kind of come to one another's defense upon the issuing of a negative criticism. But I think that can be done in a productive way. And I think that artists need, you know, defending themselves, or maybe that's a little too strong, but I think just articulating what it is that they're up to, what it is that they find compelling or provocative or important about their piece, you know, if it encourages more of a self-articulation of one's own practice, I think that it can be really beneficial throughout throughout the greater, you know, kind of arts context that everyone's working within. That being said, I do think that, you know, we do have a kind of pat each other on the back sort of a relationship to the arts here in Kansas City, which produces, I think, an incredible amount of, you know, like people are each other's comrades.
And there's a safety net in that.
Yeah. And so, and that's a nice place to be working into, wherein people do feel vulnerable in their art practice. But at the same time, I think that if the criticism can come from a place that is encouraging of new points of view, something to complicate and expand and broaden the artwork, I think that it could be a really positive and beneficial thing.
As far as this politeness issue goes, I promise I'll let go of this in a second, but do you think that the size of the city and the number of, say, funding opportunities or institutions where you can show work, do you think that maybe that's part of the politeness, is that there's just a real danger as far as opportunity goes in or perceived danger in being critical or being criticized.
Yeah, I think that people don't want to ostracize themselves or make themselves appear difficult to work with or thorny in whatever way. And then I also do think that when there is a perception of fragility, because the arts context is small and emergent, that, you know, any sort of negative criticism just will further alienate a broader public from the arts. So I think that there is this kind of need to be supportive, in the sense that, you know, we're excited when new spaces emerge. We're excited when artists are premiering new work, because it's keeping the motor running. You know, it's keeping the train on track in a lot of ways. So discouragement in the context of, you know, a perceivably fragile arts context, I could see why people shy away from criticism.
So just backing up for a second, what does a curator in residence do?
Oh, gosh. Well, I have, since I've been here, I've curated 3 exhibitions for La Esquina Gallery that have included local artists as well as national artists. And I have conducted more studio visits to even name.
What happens on a studio visit?
Well, artist will kind of reach out to me, or I'll reach out to an artist. And, you know, I'm the type of person that, or the type of curator that doesn't necessarily come into an artist's studio and expect an artist to make their work interesting to me. I really like getting to know what a person is looking at and thinking about, and what books they're reading and what artists they're really into. And I sort of like develop that kind of world, the kind of culture that the artist sees themselves working within. And then I see myself honestly kind of as a friend and then as a encourager. You know, I am one that very much shies away from the establishment of canons, the establishment of hierarchies of value, the establishment of trends. I appreciate artists that are working within their own self-defined vernacular, their own sets of materials, their own sets of concerns. And I think my job as a curator, what I'd like my job as a curator to be, is just to really play a supportive function, to bring in additional points of view, to point them in different directions in terms of research or galleries or other artists that could influence their work. Yeah, so I would say that's really the role that I hope to play in my studio visits.
Well, we'll hear more about that when we get back. We also want to hear from you. What do you think are the strengths and weaknesses of Kansas City's art scene? Are we too polite, too political? Are we confrontational enough? And what are we getting right that other cities might not be? Call us up and weigh in. The number is 816-235-2888. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, talking today with Danny Orendorf, curator in residence from the Charlotte Street Foundation. He's wrapping up his first year here in town, and we're finding out what his perceptions have been of Kansas City's art scene, and we'll also talk a little bit about a show that's up right now that he curated. But for now, we want to get you in on this conversation. What do you think are the strengths and weaknesses of Kansas City's art scene? Where do we have room to grow as an art city? And what are we getting right? Call us up. 816-235-2888 is the number to dial. That's 816-235-2888. And Danny, what do you think is the benefit of being a curator from outside the city? Mm-hmm. Kind of after a year here, you're kind of an outsider insider.
Mm-hmm. You mean the benefit for the local arts community?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that if I can come in and disrupt a few kind of set standards or set kind of hierarchies, I would hope that that's a function I can perform. You know, one of the things that I'm really proud of that I accomplished, you know, in the last year was teaching my own class at the Kansas City Art Institute. It was called The People's Art, and It took Howard Zinn's A People's History as kind of a launching pad for an art history class. So we looked at how artists have participated within social justice movements since the founding of America, really. And a lot of that was guided by another book called A People's Art History by an art historian named Nicholas Lampert. And what I could tell during the course was that this was one of the first opportunities for students there to really encounter these kinds of legacies of art production. So introducing different types of artists into the canon of artists that they were learning about in their art history classes there felt really great, you know, to kind of push beyond artists that have either been institutionally validated or market validated and into artists that were doing activist street level action. So
talk more about that validation piece of things. What is the significance of that, and how do you go about learning about artists who haven't been validated in those ways?
Well, I think that you look to the art historians and the curators that champion artwork that has been historically neglected or undervalued. And I certainly veered in that direction in my own graduate school education, primarily studying feminist art production, art production by people who identify as queer, anti-racist art production. And, you know, it's difficult. I often say one of the things that you have to do as an art historian or a critic or a curator that is invested in non-normative or non-institutional or non-market-oriented forms of art production, that you kind of have to do twice the work. You have to learn the kind of status quo, business as usual version of things. You have to learn the sort of art history as it's written about by the, you know, preordained authorities.
History is written by the victors, as they say.
Yes, absolutely. And then this is obviously the sort of Howard Zinn influence in what I do. But so you kind of have to learn those arguments and be able to confront those arguments first in order to kind of champion and steward the practices that have been neglected or left out.
You mentioned teaching a course at the Kansas City Art Institute. Yeah. How do you think it does affect Kansas City's art scene to have a school like that, and also the conservatory at UMKC?
Well, you know, I think that art schools are these incredible opportunities for young artists to really sink into their practice in that sort of inward way that I was talking about earlier. One of the things that I find problematic is that there's not sometimes a broad liberal arts education. I went to a public university. I didn't go to a private art school for undergrad, but I went to a private art school for graduate school. And I think that being in a public university as an undergraduate exposed me to so many different perspectives and really made me aware of how art practice can sit, you know, equally in other sort of disciplines and other fields and other backgrounds and intervene within them.
You talked about wanting to be a journalist, but wanting to have something to write about, sort of the same thing. An artist needs something to make art about.
Yeah, well, I would say that that's kind of been my, I find that, you know, arts that are addressing the social and the cultural and the political and so forth, are able to do so in ways that are full of affect, that are full of emotion, that are full of provocative statement making in a way that you can't really do as a journalist, but that it sort of works in parallel or in tandem to journalism and current events and sociology. So how arts can be provocative of conversations that aren't strictly limited to yesterday's news, but are imagining alternative futures, that are putting pressure on social institutions that run our lives.
Well, yeah, we've got a caller who wants to weigh in on this. We've got William in Leawood, and we're going to go to him in a second. But if you want to join the conversation, call us up at 816-235-2888. What do you think of Kansas City's art scene, and where do we have room to grow? That number again, 816-235-2888. Good morning, William.
Good Good morning. How's it going? Danny, nice talking to you.
Hi.
You're kind of making my point, but you were kind of dancing around the issue a little bit about Kansas City. I've lived there 32 years.
Well, how would you put it?
Well, and it's funny that you mentioned Chicago and San Francisco because I go there quite often. In fact, I'm trying to move my company from, it's a technology company, from Olathe, Kansas to San Francisco, to San Jose. And partly I'm doing that because even though I'm in the scientific business, I find that the quality of people that I can hire here, which I'm also really calling about, is the arts part of it, because my son is a musician and an artist. And he's currently living in Oklahoma City, but I've encouraged him to move to San Francisco because I feel that there, people are not looking to, they're not shy to be criticized. And I think that's kind of the key. In the same vein, you're talking about journalism. I can also talk about the Kansas City Chiefs and the Kansas City Royals. These teams are really good teams, and you know, they also support, the owners have supported arts communities in the past. But the problem is that the teams never get criticized for quality, and the same way with the artwork. Whether I go to the West Bottoms, when I go to, you know, the commercial art fairs that are in the Plaza and the Brookside, it seems to me that criticism is a central part of being an artist and developing the quality. And I feel that the Kansas City community, although is very good.
I love this idea of the art scene being kind of like treated like a baseball or football team, where it's like it's our team. And so we cheer for them no matter what.
Well, and that's a great point. I mean, it's actually a great analogy. I had a conversation years ago with Tyler Green, who's a art journalist, Modern Art Notes, and he sort of started. He started as a sports writer, and he had this great, you know, kind of story about, you know, even as a sports journalist, when he wanted to criticize, you know, this big buff baseball player's performance, you know, that can be a really intimidating thing, because you still have to show up in the locker room the next day, you know, and it does take bravery. It takes a certain sense of professionalism. And that is, you know, it's a risk. And, you know, just as much as the artist is vulnerable in displaying their artwork, the critic is vulnerable in being very honest about their opinions. And certainly I think that social media kind of exacerbates that sense. The thing that I would want to add to it about Chicago and San Francisco is that I don't know if those cities necessarily produce more political artists because of criticism, but I would say that there are artists living and working in the art schools there that are very broad and diverse in terms of what their practices are, their backgrounds are, their political beliefs and actions are. And I think that that sort of example setting of, hey, here's another way that you can be an artist, those sort of role models might be less accessible or less visible here in Kansas City. So I think that seeing like a plethora of artist practices locally will help inspire greater diversity amongst the artwork that's being made by young people. So, for instance, there's a great artist here in town, Caitlin Horseman, who also is one of the founders of Plug Projects, and she's a filmmaker, and I believe she might makes video, but, you know, her work is like social, cultural documentary, sort of pseudo-documentary sometimes. And I think that the fact that she's here, that she's teaching, that she's, you know, a visible artist that also has an affiliation with a gallery will hopefully, you know, inspire young artists to emulate her kind of practice.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Danny Orendorf, curator in residence at the Charlotte Street Foundation. And Danny, you do have a show up right now, and yes. I don't want to get out of here without talking to you about that. It is called, speaking of provocative, it is called The Stench of Rotting Flowers.
Yes.
Could you tell us about the premise of that show?
Sure. So The Stench of Rotting Flowers. I know, I can't believe that I curated an art show called The Stench of Rotting Flowers. Like, that's sort of the fun part of being this curatorial resident is I really get to sort of do unfiltered projects. So The Scent of Rotting Flowers is the show that is kind of part of a three-part investigation that I've done over this past year into the representation of bad feelings and depression in particular. So my first show, We'll Make Out Better Okay, had a lot to do with political depression. My second show, The Tyranny of Good Taste, had a lot to do with personal economic depression.
The Tyranny of Good Taste is another wonderful title.
Oh, thank you. And then the third show, The Scent of Rotting Flowers, really had to do with this sort of emotional depression. And I was very interested in how we kind of indulge in bad feelings, you know, how we how bad feelings, sadness can be labor intensive and time consuming. And, you know, that goes from both, you know, a heartbreak, how we kind of like to stew in our depression and our sort of ache around all of that, to, you know, the sort of labor intensity of planning a funeral. And so in a lot of ways, I wanted to kind of point to these qualities of sadness and depression that complicate a kind of sad monotone of it all, and how artists are filtering all of these kind of different aspects and qualities of bereavement or grief or heartbreak into artwork that is unconventional, artwork that is labor intensive, artwork that maybe even includes humor, that is ritualistic, that it is repetitive. So The Stench of Rotting Flowers is inspired by that kind of mood and feeling.
There's kind of a stereotype about artists, or I don't know, a platitude that you have to experience these dark, difficult things. Like, you have to be a tortured soul to be an artist. How does this show kind of play into that idea, or with it?
It absolutely plays into it. I think that in a tongue-in-cheek way, you know? And I think that that's, complicated. Even the Tyranny of Good Taste had a lot to do with, you know, artists being broke, right? And this also being a kind of stereotype of the artist's life, you know, broke, maybe hoarding materials, this kind of thing. But certainly within The Stench of Rotting Flowers, there's sort of a parody of this kind of Victorian idea of the starving, romantic, depressed artist. And, you know, but we live in a very different time and place, you know, and so I would say that a lot of the work is also kind of points to, you know, when you get to spend that much time bereavement or grieving or with bereavement, there's also a sort of kind of privilege within it. So a lot of the work is decorative, and a lot of the work sort of points towards that sort of kind of class of materials. Yeah.
And it seems heavy, like physically as a material, a lot of the work feels really heavy. Yeah. I'm thinking of Bouquet by Jeff Tackett. Could you talk about that work and describe it really visually for
us? Sure. Well, you would also have to describe how it smells, because so Jeff Tackett made this incredible installation called Bouquet, where he hand formed all of these flowers out of sugar and frosting, and created a bed that is basically a horizontal painting, but entirely out of his handmade cake objects. And so it's this just incredibly, you know, lustrous object that it sits very quietly and dimly lit in its own room within the gallery. And it smells so intensely of sugar. So I think we were playing with the idea of, you know, when something is so sincere, it becomes saccharine. You know, when something is so kind of heartfelt and sentimental that it becomes just this tooth-aching, sugary thing in your life. And I think that his work really kind of brought that out in a really gorgeous and brilliant way.
What about For Health and Strength by Hope Esser, that video work?
Yeah, well, Hope Esser, you know, she's really inspired by statuary and kind of the religious iconography of ecstasy. So a lot of her work is inspired by just this simple premise of trying to hold one posture until you can no longer do it anymore, until fatigue sets in, until something environmental disrupts that posture. And she's a performance artist. And so within For Health and Strength, you know, she set up this kind of premise where she'd be with her sister consuming but also singing into these massive goblets of red wine while the wine, you know, splashes and spills all over herself and the table and everything. But then this kind of incredible moment happens, you know, when the glass breaks, kind of disrupting the whole premise of her performance. And it was that kind of rupture of levity into this very static, kind of sad circumstance.
Yeah, they were like drowning in the wine.
They're drowning in wine. They're copiously, they're consuming all of this red wine in order to forget, you know, some unspecified moment. And
there's an empty chair, sort of an glaringly empty chair.
Yeah, it's sort of in this empty cavernous space, this cavernous dining room table. But I love, for me, it really was that moment when the situation is disturbed and you can't sit in it anymore because it broke, right? And you can't help but laugh. And that, I think that is the moment with grief or sadness that I'm also very, was interested in.
You've got, your residency has been extended. What is your, do you have a goal that you thought maybe you wouldn't be able to achieve, but now you can?
Yeah, I mean, really have wanted to work with archives locally. So the next project in the fall, I will be engaging materials at both the Gay and Lesbian Archives of Mid-America and the Black Archives of Mid-America in order to do just what I was sort of talking about earlier, which is kind of situate art practices within more social and political and economic contexts. So.
Well, that is all the time we have for today's conversation. Thanks so much, Dani Orendorff, curator in residence at the Charlotte Street Foundation. It has been so fun talking with you today.
Thank you. It's been great.
If you'd like to listen back to today's show or any previous conversations you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/Central Standard. You'll find past shows archived there. Tomorrow, we take a closer look at a side of our city we generally prefer not to think about. Our sewers. We'll take you to the city's bowels and check in on the largest public works project in Kansas City history. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date next.